Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view. The people who work in the prison system would have another. And I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. And a warning that this episode of Doin' Time contains descriptions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died and discussion of deaths in custody. First up on the show, we will bring you an interview with Professor Destaria, an academic from Western Sydney University. The discussion will focus on a new report co-authored by the professor from the Whitlam Institute and Human Rights Law Centre, charting 5 decades of attempts to deliver an Australian Human Rights Act and how this reform could now be closer than ever. After that, you will hear from Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Coalition, who was also a speaker at yesterday's rally, says no to racism, no to March for Australia. He will give a report back. Finally, we will bring you an eyewitness account from David Glantz from the Refugee Action Collective about an anti-racist rally that happened in Melbourne at the State Library. We will have the professor on shortly to discuss the report and I will go into it in more detail. But first up, we'll have a very short announcement. And also, it's Marissa and I'll be taking you through until 5 o'clock this evening. I barely made it because I'm just recovering from a bug. So stay tuned.
I'm lucky and I'm clever.
It's time again for Done By Law's legendary annual trivia night. We know you've been waiting and yes, it is here. Grab some teammates and come along to catch up with like-minded folks in the community legal sector and beyond and try your luck at taking home trivia glory. We're raising much-needed funds for the incredible 3CR. 3CR is 100% community controlled and relies on annual fundraising to keep its amazing local content on air. Friday 24th of October, 6:30 p.m. at the Richmond Town Hall. Tickets available via 3cr.org.au/done-by-law.
And in case you've just tuned in, this is the Doin' Time Show, 3CR. New report shows Human Rights Act closest to becoming law in decades. So we'll be interviewing Professor Destaria, and she's from the Western Sydney University. She's an academic, and she co-authored the report, Legislating Human Rights Act, from Whitlam to now. And the report traces a long and unfinished journey from Whitlam's first human rights bill in 1973 and examines how successive governments have tried and failed to deliver an Australian Human Rights Act. The report shows how efforts have been derailed by a pattern of political opposition and misinformation rather than a lack of public support. Can Anthony Albanese establish an Australian Human Rights Act, take a practical step in repairing Australia's broken system of rights protections and ensure human rights remain at the forefront of government decision-making for decades to come? Professor Destaria will speak to the challenges Australia has faced in legislating a Human Rights Act, the benefits an Australian Human Rights Act would provide for people, and why Australia could be closer than ever in the political opportunity to achieve one. Hello, Professor. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Now, I'm wondering if you could just briefly introduce yourself in case there are any corrections to your bio.
Oh, no, you did a wonderful job. So I'm Asda Stiari. I'm the director of the Centre for Western Sydney at Western Sydney University. And yeah, feel free to call me As.
Thanks, As. How lovely to have you. As, would you just be able to talk about the report? And look, this is actually long overdue, and there's a lot of history, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Gough Whitlam tried to introduce the Human Rights Act as 53 years ago, and he was unsuccessful, obviously, in doing it because, you know, all of these decades on, we still don't have a Human Rights Act. And he wanted to introduce the Human Rights Act because he could see that our country needed it for its democracy, to make sure that we're protecting the vulnerable, and to make sure that we're actually abiding by our international agreements and ratifying our international treaties and implementing our obligations into Australian law. But from the time that Gough tried to introduce the Human Rights Act to now, there has been this really sustained opposition to having more rights protections in our legal system. And the people that don't want us to have human rights protections in our laws have really recycled the same arguments against the Human Rights Act over and over again. And they've used arguments like our system doesn't need it, we already have existing protections, that somehow having a Human Rights Act would lead us to have less protection, or that government, parliament would have less power and judges would have more power. But what we've seen is that over the years, these arguments that, again, keep getting recycled have lost some of their bite, because we've had these Human Rights Acts in Victoria, of course, but also in Queensland, in the ACT. And what people have seen is that when these Human Rights Acts have been introduced, we have had greater protections, we have had governments think about human rights before passing legislation, and we've seen that there are a lot of things we can do, a lot of models we can put into place that don't take too much power from governments, like the politicians, and don't hand too much power to the judges, but just make sure that public authorities, that decision makers, and that lawmakers have to consider human rights before they make legislation. So because of the passing of these acts in other parts of Australia, still not federally, and because we're seeing that it's very needed, the Royal Commissions, for example, into disability, into aged care, have shown us what can go wrong. Robo-debt has shown us what can go wrong when governments don't think about human rights, and that the patchwork of protections we have at the moment are not enough. So there's a real push again to pass the Human Rights Act that has kind of really ignited at the moment.
It's very interesting that these things are talked about by government, saying that that they're going to lose power. That happens a lot,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that sometimes it's a really good thing for governments to have to consider human rights. So it's actually false to think that governments would lose too much power. Like we've seen in the model in Victoria, for example, that fortunately or unfortunately, governments wanted to. They can still pass acts that are in violation of human rights. They just have to say that they're doing it, and that the act that they're passing or legislation they're passing is inconsistent with human rights. So a Human Rights Act doesn't necessarily stop governments from passing legislation or losing too much power. What it does do is make governments have to fess up and say that they are passing legislation that's not human rights compliant. So it makes them think about human rights. And it also means that they're answerable to the public, who can go, oh, okay, you've openly said that this piece of legislation is not compliant with human rights. So it adds kind of this public pressure, but it doesn't limit the power to pass legislation that they want to pass. So that kind of argument of, we're not going to have enough power to run government properly is a really false one.
Very false indeed. I mean, is there a way that we can perhaps discuss Aboriginal deaths in custody?
Absolutely.
The show, the Doing Time show, really looks at a lot of police powers, Aboriginal deaths in custody, and looks quite a lot at violations of human rights for prisoners and, you know, all marginalised communities. How could a Human Rights Act be applied to that? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really good example of what we have at the moment isn't working. We have too many, I mean, one person is too many, Aboriginal deaths in custody. We have inhumane conditions in our prisons. We have a system that's very, very broken. Now, a Human Rights Act wouldn't necessarily fix everything, nor would it fix everything overnight. But what it would do is make governments and public authorities, so it's, if it's a federal prison, the federal prison would have to be regulated by legislation that has to take human rights into consideration. So it would strengthen human rights in those kinds of systems. Again, I think there's, you know, a piece of legislation can't do everything, but it's a big step forward in making sure that governments have to think about human rights when they're making rules about prisons, when they're making rules about conditions, when they're, you know, making decisions about what happens inside our prison system.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we would be important to note here is in regards to that, hopefully there would be less rights that would be breached, because at the moment there is a serious breach, not only in our prison system, but also with the way that Aboriginal people have been treated in our society.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely true. Again, a Human Rights Act can't do everything. Victoria does have a Human Rights Act, and we're seeing that that hasn't solved all the problems of the state prisons, but it helps. It really does help, and it will help at the federal level as well. And we've got a really uneven system at the moment, so some states have Human Rights Acts, some don't. So if we're just using the example of prisons, we have better protections in some parts of Australia and not in others. But I think when it comes to things like the treatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in our country, there's just so much work that has to be done in so many different areas, and a Human Rights Act is part of that attempt to kind of undo a little bit of the violence of colonisation that we're seeing continue today.
Indeed. And in fact, I'm wondering then if you could comment on how political opponents have also represented a reasonable and necessary addition, but they've also historically sought to create fear and division.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a real attempt to paint a Human Rights Act as almost evil. In fact, they have used the language of evil as if the people that are fighting for a Human Rights Act are not trying to protect the most vulnerable and also keep governments accountable, but that they're somehow trying to take people's rights away. And the best way we can combat that is to educate ourselves, educate each other. A lot of people think we have a Human Rights Act. So Amnesty International did a survey, and the majority of the Australian people, 75%, want a Human Rights Act. Only 3% don't. But a lot of people also think we already have one, and I think we can blame American TV for that as well. So to combat kind of the opposition, which is a small opposition but a very vocal opposition, we need to keep talking about how much our society would benefit from a Human Rights Act, how much it would help things like Indigenous deaths in custody, a prison reform. It would help with healthcare. It would help with housing. It would help with education. the fact that this has tangible, real consequences if we're able to pass an act like that, and not engage too much with arguments that are often made not in good faith. They're just trying to kind of sensationalising to weaken the campaign. Yeah.
I mean, really, God help us if the government has to exercise transparency here.
Yeah. That's I think about human rights acts, yeah, before passing legislation, yeah.
It beggars belief. I mean, I was actually watching SBS last night and I was quite appalled, and it was such a disgrace that, you know, a treaty has just come through to Victoria and the Liberal government will repeal it. You know, there seems to be an ongoing pattern here that anything good, you know, always has to be, taken away.
I think it's an ongoing struggle, isn't it? If we take two steps forward, we might have to be pushed one step back. But I think as long as, you know, people are engaged in the good fight, we have people like you educating the public, then hopefully they can't take everything away, and hopefully we'll make wins so that we can ensure that we're living in a more just, more fair, more equal country.
Indeed. Could you just tell listeners the link to the report?
Yeah, so if they go to the Human Rights Law Centre's website, there should be a link to the report from the Human Rights Law Centre's website. So I'll direct everyone to go there. There you will also find the campaign for a Human Rights Act, so you can sign up, you can read more about it. But yeah, head up to the Human Rights Law Centre.
Thank you so much, Professor, for coming onto the program.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate everything that you do, and good luck with the wonderful program.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
And you're back with the Do and Time show. And you just heard an interview with the Professor Dastaria, about a report legislating human rights acts from Whitlam to now. And that's very interesting reading. Do go onto the website of the Human Rights Law Centre and have a look at that. Hello. And also, we're going to now be speaking with Ian Rintel. We will be bringing you our second interview shortly. And he is going to be speaking about, oh, my goodness, it's such a mess now with what's happening with the March Australia Now, for Australia Now rally. He's going to talk about that, give an eyewitness account, and hopefully we can discuss what's happening with all this nonsense about anti-immigration. Hello, Ian, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Marissa.
Thank you so much for coming. I know you've got a meeting coming up soon.
That's okay. Thank you.
Now, Ian, I'm wondering if you could just tell us what's been going on in regards to what happened yesterday.
Yeah, well, I was in Sydney, so probably some of your listeners are going to have a better idea what took place in Melbourne, but I've spoken
That's
to
okay. I'll be crossing over to David Glantz after you.
Oh, okay, too easy then. Yeah, look, I mean, yesterday was another, you know, mobilisation by March for Australia, you know, right across the country, and shamefully we saw some of the same politicians, you know, Pauline Hanson, John Ruddick, Libertarian, so-called, Malcolm Roberts, you know, another, you know, One Nation speaking to the rally in, you know, in Brisbane. So we saw, I think, some very, you know, shameful things again of, you know, some of the mainstream politicians giving, you know, succour and support to what is clearly a, you know, far right and sometimes explicit with explicit, you know, Nazi, you know, connections. Even yesterday, While the National Socialist Network said they weren't particularly mobilising for March Australia, there were clearly, you know, Nazi organisers and Nazi-affiliated individuals taking responsibility, you know, for organising the rally. So there were responses right across the country, counter-protests of one sort or another. We had maybe 700 people in, you know, in Sydney, and United Against Racism racism rally to take to the streets in Sydney to make send a very clear message, you know, that the streets there's no welcome for, you know, for Nazis, no welcome for racism on the streets of Sydney.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Nazis are actually seeking? What are the demands? They're saying that there's too many immigrants. It's going to take away jobs. They're frightening people, aren't they?
Look, it's all the same kind of rubbish. Actually, it's not so different to the stuff we actually get from, you know, One Nation, behind the kind of the general anti-immigrant, you know, position, although the literature that I saw is clearly more explicitly, you know, far right wing, you know, politics than what the first March for Australia was, just kind of, you know, wrap yourself in the flag and, you know, we're against mass migration or against immigrants. But when you, well, there's no fine print anymore, you know, that's very clear on the stuff they put out in Sydney, at least, you know, that there's explicit anti-Indian racism. There's explicit argument that somehow or other, you know, having Indian nurses or nurses and doctors from foreign countries, you know, lowers standards in healthcare, lowers wages. There was all the most appalling, you know, sort of racist, the usual kind of, you know, racist myths, you know, that it's you know, foreign people buying houses for the reason there's a housing crisis. I mean, there's just so much nonsense, you know, being peddled. And I think what we haven't seen, and why, you know, we did organise, you know, rallies to respond, is that, you know, the myths need to be exploded. You know, there is a housing crisis, but it's not because there are, you know, too many migrants. You know, we've got a government that won't put rent caps. We've got governments which don't support, you know, public housing and, you know, any longer, you know, and yeah, we've seen a situation even in, you know, in Sydney, where people are actually being evicted, you know, from public housing to make way for, you know, so-called, you know, public-private, you know, sort of, you know, arrangements. So the consequences are is that there is less housing, but it's not migration. It's the government we have to point the finger very 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 pointedly at.
So to specify, basically yesterday, a Unite Against Racism, Migrants and Refugees, a welcome community rally was held in Belmore Park yesterday. Can you just tell us, I know it was called by a broad cross-section of unions and community groups.
Yes.
Can you just tell us who the speakers were?
We have Maureen Faruqi speaking from the New South Wales Green Senator. Yeah, obviously, we had Natasha Watts, who's the Deputy Vice President of the Teachers Federation. We had Lara, who's a trans asylum seeker and threatened with deportation for writing pro-Palestine slogans on the, you know, university, you know, blackboards. There was a speaker from Students for Palestine. We had Shannon Potter from Labor for Civil Liberties. So, a very, very broad, you know, cross-section of people and support from a number of unions, you know, to make it clear that Sydney is united against racism.
I find it really interesting, you know, the March for Australia gains legitimacy, doesn't it, for mainstream government policies that scapegoat migrants for government failures to address the housing and cost of living crises. The media release also comments about the fact that it introduces Trump-like deportation laws. Can you comment on that?
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things which listeners may have heard about from, you know, other sources, but, you know, in the last few weeks, the government introduced quite explicit laws which gives them the power to actually remove people from Australia, you know, to Nauru. And we've seen, you know, well, the government says there may be 13 and up to 20 people who have been, you know, given these Nauru visas. We know certainly of at least 8 of them who are, have been taken back into detention because they have been grabbed off the street or usually from home very early in the morning, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. There are raids. They're being picked up, put in detention, given these visas saying you're going to be deported to Nauru. So the Labor government has given themselves, Trump-like powers. And even shamefully yesterday, Tony Burke was on the, Insiders program and just parrots, not only support for that and, sees some positive benefit in that, those kind of Trump-like powers, but also spouts the same nonsense about, Labor's bringing down, we're bringing down the immigration rates and the immigration rates, and that's the kind of thing which does give sustenance to the argument that somehow or other it's immigration which is responsible for the cost of living crisis, the crisis in government services, the crisis in hospitals, and so forth. So you've got more explicit stuff coming from Andrew Hastie in the right wing of the Liberal Party, where he says quite explicitly, we're not sure we live in Australia any longer, and points to mass migration, as he calls it, as being somehow responsible for those crises in Australian society. It's just
and he mentions the post-pandemic influx of migrants. I mean, seriously, Ian.
You don't need to have too many neurons to rub together to work out that it is nonsense. But that's what's dangerous, when this nonsense actually comes from the mainstream. It's picked up, and we've got thousands of people actually in the streets of Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, who are mobilised around somehow or other the ideas of March for Australia. It's a nonsense.
So, Ian, finally, what I wanted to ask you is, what was the police presence like, and were the Nazis there? I mean, did they have a separate rally as well? Can you paint a picture for listeners?
Yeah, there was. Yes, I mean, that was the reason we actually organised the demonstration in Sydney yesterday. The March for Australia was in Hyde Park. We're in Belmore Park. Now, our paths didn't cross, and there were big police presence at different points as we marched around the streets of Sydney to make sure that the paths didn't cross. We weren't particularly interested in crossing paths in Sydney. At this stage, it was a matter of simply trying to get as many people in the streets of Sydney to make it clear, that they were anti-racists in Sydney that would organise against them, and that's what we attempt to do. So the police are relatively restrained in Sydney compared to what I've seen in Melbourne, obviously.
Oh my God, I'm going to be speaking with David Glantz soon from the Refugee Action Collective. Apparently, it was terrible yesterday.
Yeah, okay, well.
But I'll let you go pretty soon. But just one last thing, Pauline Hanson and Bob Kader. Spoke at the March for Australia rallies in August.
Yep.
And that's pretty appalling, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's the same picture that I've been trying to paint in terms of, from the Labor Party to Hastie to One Nation, and the stuff that I saw from Malcolm Roberts speaking at the Brisbane rally, even worse, than the kind of stuff that was said in August, like really, really pushing the whole things about mass migration and somehow or other the Australian way of life, being at risk, because of that, and it's a disgrace, that people like, Bob Catter and Malcolm Roberts and Pauline Hanson actually are seen to be on platforms and in rallies, that do have explicit Nazis, marching alongside them and taking responsibility for organising the rallies. But that's another point of the way in which, the racism at the top of the society is boosting, these far right groupings, and we have to do both things. We've got to fight that mainstream racism as well as deal, with the far right mobilisation.
What sets 3CR apart, and also the Doing Time show specifically, is the fact that we're here talking about the background and discussing the real issues in regards to, all the stances that not just the Nazis but mainstream government policies are peddling, whereas you've got your mainstream media that do nothing of the sort. All they're talking about is the so-called violence, throwing rocks at the police, all that type of stuff.
No. We need much more, critical media, Marissa, and the more 3CR can get that the word out. And the mainstream media plays a shameful role, I think, by not, critically addressing, by simply allowing, Andrew to give endless column inches to Andrew Hastie, or to report, uncritically what Malcolm Roberts or Pauline Hanson has got to say, let alone, any kind of positive coverage of March for Australia. So, yes, we need the critical media. We need people, and not just in the media, in every workplace, every uni, every school, actually, taking a stand. Why we have to fight, the racism we get from the government and the racism we get from March for Australia.
Ian, thank you so much for coming onto the program. I'll let you get to your meeting.
Okay, thanks very much, Minister.
We can chat to you soon.
Yep, will do. Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
And you're back with the Do and Time Show, 3CR Community Radio, and it's approximately 4:31. And you just heard an interview with Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Coalition, and he spoke about what happened at the rally at Belmore Park, and talked about some of the government policies and of anti-immigration, and spoke about a lot of things about the fact that there were Nazis at the rally, and lots of other things. I'm now going to cross over to David Glantz, and he will give an eyewitness account of what happened at the anti-racist rally in Melbourne yesterday at the State Library. Hello, David. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
David, I can barely hear you. Are you there?
Yes, is that better?
That's a bit better. Yeah,
okay,
I'm just getting over a bug in case you think my voice sounds a bit different.
You do sound a little croaky, so good on
that's
you for
okay.
Sticking with it.
Anyway, I'm wondering if you could just talk yesterday about what happened at the rally and just give a little bit of an update and report back.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think we started off very strong. I would say between 1,500 and 2,000 people formed up at the State Library and then marched through the city. Our aim was always to get as close as we could to the racists, to outnumber them, to shout them down, demoralise them, and make them feel like it wasn't worth turning up to rallies. And unfortunately, the Victoria Police put enormous resources into making that very, very difficult. And then when they had the opportunity, they used that enormous array of weapons that they have available to them nowadays to attack and in some cases badly injure a number of anti-racist protesters. So I didn't see the use of rubber bullets and flashbangs, but I've seen video of it and people have reported it. I was in part of the rally that got cut off and in the end went back to Flinders Street Station and then Camp Sovereignty. But what I did see was massive use of capsicum spray. I saw people who were committing no crime copping capsicum spray in their face, all over their clothes, over some minor incident, so minor I couldn't see it, but the police went absolutely crazy. And anybody within sort of 10 metres range of them really copped it very, very hard. And as I say, although I personally didn't see it, we do know, and there's loads of evidence, there's video on Facebook and Insta, of the police using flashbangs and rubber bullets. And I hear there are some quite severe injuries. And, of course, the police always tell us about their injuries, whether they're minor or major. But they always say they don't know of any injuries amongst the protesters that they haven't been reported. but I'm reporting it to you now. There were injuries. There were certainly people who suffered very badly with capsicum spray, and there were people who were hit by rubber bullets. And I know from previous experience, having flashbangs go off near you is disconcerting and potentially deafening. So we saw some very heavy-duty violence by the police, all in the name of protecting the March for Australia racists. I think the good news was I think we outnumbered them. I'm pretty clear we outnumbered them. There were, I think, probably no more than 1,000 racists at Parliament, maybe even less, whereas I think we probably had up to double that number on our side. And therefore, I think we've shown them once again that if they rally on the streets of Melbourne to call for racist measures against migrants, then they will always be outnumbered in Melbourne. And that's obviously the positive side of the equation.
Can you actually tell us or describe where did this March for Australia take place? And was this more a counter-protest or was it more an anti-racist rally that was happening?
They gathered at Parliament and had speeches on the steps of Parliament. They had the intersection there at the corner of Spring and Burke. Our rally was a counter-rally. The plan was to march as close as possible, outnumber them, outshout them, and then move away safely. The police attack that I outlined, the use of capsicum spray, caused confusion and contributed to our rally, unfortunately, breaking up into a number of sections, which meant, which was unfortunate, but we can say with confidence that our counter-rally was substantially bigger. There was a wide array of people there from across the left and progressive movements. I personally saw people I know from, obviously, the Refugee Action Collective, because we mobilised and called on our supporters to join the rally. I saw people there from the Loud Jew Collective, different socialist and anarchist organisations, but just a broad range of people who are appalled by racism, appalled by the scapegoating of migrants. And as the Refugee Action Collective, we actually put out a leaflet around the crowd yesterday before we set off, saying that we were proud to be on that rally, to be part of the counter-mobilisation, but emphasising something which, if I just caught the tail end of your chat with Ian Rentoul, but we emphasise something I think is very important, which is we can't defeat racism just by mobilising from time to time against racist rallies, because the racism is being injected into society at all sorts of levels, including at the highest level. So we pointed out there's official racism, which then gives confidence to the racists on the streets in all shapes and forms. Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, admitted, according to The Age this morning, that migration was too high. Well, the moment you concede that ground, you are saying that there's something wrong with migration, and that very quickly becomes something wrong with migrants. We obviously pointed out on the leaflet the way that the government is treating refugees, with thousands of people living completely uncertain lives, unable to plan their future in Australia. We pointed out that while the Nazis of the National Socialist Network call for deportations, Labor is actually deporting people. It's deporting people who supposedly have bad character under what's known as the 501 provision. And I know you and I have talked about that in the past, yep. Marissa, that non-citizens don't really have to do anything very much wrong to find themselves in detention and then deported. But now the government has given itself sweeping new powers to deport over 350 people to Nauru in a deal which is going to cost us, the taxpayers, $408 million up front and $2.5 billion over 30 years. So in many ways, we don't have to worry about the Nazis calling for deportations. We have to worry about this Labor government organising deportations. So we made the point that whether it's housing or demonising international students, those sorts of racist responses are coming from the people at the top of society, and that in turn gives confidence to the scum of March for Australia to come out onto the streets because they think their position has been vindicated. So we encouraged everybody there yesterday, obviously to march yesterday, but then to get organised and active to defend refugee rights and to oppose deportations and the scapegoating of migrants and international students for that matter.
And look, the Nazis have been around for years, but I suppose I have noticed as a radio broadcaster, you know, doing interviews week in, week out, I have noticed that they have risen and have gone more for these marches. But I think a comment that Ian made and also that I talked about, and I want to see what you think of this, David, is that the March for Australia gains legitimacy from mainstream government policies that scapegoat migrants for government failures to address the housing and cost of living crisis.
Absolutely. I think it's important that we take the Nazi threat seriously, but that we don't panic. I think when sometimes people around the place say, we've got to oppose the Nazi march, as if there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Nazis on our streets.
Correct.
I think that scares people more than they need to be and risks paralysing people so they feel that nothing can be done. Right now, the Nazis, they're better organised than they were a year or 2 years ago, but they're still very small. In Melbourne, they really can't get more than 30 people onto the street, even when surrounded by the March for Australia or, you know, I think the largest rally I'm aware of is when they had their national conference and 100 of them marched through the CBD at 1 o'clock in the morning. So when were absolutely safe, and that was 100 people. So these people are not big, but of course we want to stop them before they get bigger. But to do that, we need to actually try and turn off the gushing tap of racism, which they're swimming. You know, they're swimming in this pool of racism, and that so much of it comes from the top. So we have a situation, like I say, Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, the man in charge of migration programs, says yes, there are too many migrants. Well, when he says that, he's basically allowing people to think, yes, there are too many migrants, that's why I can't get a house. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually, there are all sorts of very simple reasons why people can't get houses. There are tens of thousands of houses standing empty in Victoria and around the country. That's one point. Secondly, governments have stopped building public housing, or even in some cases, social housing, which is obviously not as secure as public housing. And we know here in Victoria, they're knocking down public housing. They're actually reducing the public housing stock. And that puts pressure on demand for rental properties. And then you've got this continuous drip, drip, drip of public money, subsidies going to landlords and property speculators in the shape of negative gearing, which basically means they pay less income tax, or concessions on capital gains tax. So when they cash in a property, they pay less tax back to the government. And that, as so many other people have said, this isn't my brilliant insight. I'm just sharing a view that many people say. Housing used to be primarily something which was about shelter, security, and as you know, a sense that you belonged in the world. Now, housing is a speculative property. For those people who read The Age, they have the domain section. They have stories every other day, basically, about house prices, where you can cash in, where you can buy houses to get the best outcome.
Exactly, David.
A house
should be
somewhere where people live. And migrants are not responsible for that speculation and failure to build public housing.
Look, historically, there has been a very, very disgraceful element in government, and I'll give you a little bit of an example. You know, even growing up, even when I was at school, and also as an adult, a young adult, oh, go home, WOG. You know, you're taking our jobs. I mean, this has been rampant for, you know, for many, many years. And as my parents are migrants, and I've copped that over many years. And now it's almost like this has been given legitimacy, and it's very disturbing. And in fact, even when I was listening to the radio and watching TV last night, all they could talk about was how the cops were hospitalised.
Yeah, but they weren't talking about the fact that we've got open racists parading on the streets of Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane and so on in varying numbers, but always more than it should be, injecting poison into our society. And I think the reality is the racists are gaining in confidence, from Jacinta Price, Andrew Hastie, Barnaby Joyce, Pauline Hanson. They're beginning to think that the world is on their side. I'll tell you a story which would be funny if it wasn't serious. Last week, I was helping out the Refugee Action Collective runs public street stalls, outreach to the public several times a week. And I was helping out with one of our stalls on Sydney Road, Brunswick, which most people would regard as, you know, a solidly progressive area, left-wing area, if anything, a bit hipster. Twice in the space of 10 minutes, I was told by racists to go back where I come from. I'm white. The only reason they told me to do that, and it's two separate instances, 10 minutes
How
apart,
so?
My accent. Because I don't have an Australian accent, I've got an English accent. Literally, I was twice told in the space of 10 minutes. Now, I can brush that off because, you know, the threat to people of colour is so much greater than it could ever be to somebody like myself. But the fact that the moment these racists felt threatened or felt they needed to respond, they went for that, go back where you came from, you know, F off out of Australia. And I can sort of laugh that off. But the next person they say that to, maybe brown or black or wearing a hijab, and that is going to lead to real fear and, unfortunately, real loathing. And they get confidence to say these things, not just from the racists like Pauline Hanson, but by the federal Labor government and the federal Liberal opposition competing for who can cut migration the most. And the moment you go into a competition to cut migration, you are putting a target on the back of every migrant, whether they've been here 5 weeks, 5 years, or, you know, effectively their lifetime. You know, my own peculiar little example, it doesn't even have to be based on skin colour, just that your accent isn't ochre enough so that you fit in.
David, thank you so much for coming onto the program. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more, I'm afraid, March for Australia rallies. Any final comments?
I think we need to mobilise every time March for Australia mobilises. But I think it's really important that we organise through organisations like the Refugee Action Collective, or through community groups, or through our unions or political parties. We organise against the official racism from the top. We say that refugees are welcome here. We say that migrants are welcome here. We say that we should be taxing the rich and using the money to build public housing, to solve the public housing crisis. We can all play a role in pushing back against that official racism, and to use a MAGA quote, we can drain the racist swamp and leave the really hardened elements of the far right and the Nazis completely isolated. And we can be all can be part of that process.
Two more things before we finish the interview, and that is that we can't forget Camp Sovereignty about what happened there. And also, and I want to talk about this whole the following in more detail on this show, but it's not discussed very much. The Nazis and the white supremacists, anyone that's not perfect, anyone that they consider not perfect, like a disability, or, you know, your skin, the colour of your skin. You know, an injury to one is an injury to all.
Absolutely. With Camp Sovereignty, what happened there was, you know, a disgraceful racist crime. There are clearly a number of people who are facing charges, and for once I hope they throw the book at them. I don't normally say that about the justice system, but we all need to stand in solidarity with Camp Sovereignty and all our Indigenous brothers and sisters, wherever they are, because they could be at risk just walking down the street if a racist comes the other way. But your point about the threat that's raised by the far right and the Nazis is absolutely right. They are a threat to anybody who doesn't essentially fit into a white, fit, an overwhelmingly male worldview. And people quite rightly remember the Holocaust and 6 million Jews being killed by the Nazis under Hitler. But the first mass killings by the Nazis were actually disabled people, including German citizens, because they felt they had to establish a pure German blood, quote-unquote, and that meant actually eradicating people who didn't fit their idea of what a decent, of what a good human being should be. So,
and that
ideology
is alive and well, David.
Mm.
Sorry,
Absolutely.
What was that?
Sorry, I think I spoke over you. What was your last
point? I was just saying that ideology is still alive and well.
It is, and we need to make sure that those who believe it feel that they can get nowhere and they give up and they just, you know, rot away in the sewers where they belong.
And let's also give a shout out to and solidarity to all the people that were injured by the police yesterday. And I'm hoping that there can be some justice there.
Absolutely. And we should be calling for the disarming of the police. They have become increasingly militarised, especially over the last, I don't know, 5-10 years. The idea that we're talking about, you know, the ordinary copper on the beat, we're not. We're talking about people who look like they're soldiers with helmets and guns and all sorts of weapons, which at the end of the day are designed to hurt people. And we know it's always going to be progressive people, people of the left, who are most likely to be hurt. So calling for the disarming of the police, I think, is another thing that we should be looking at.
Thanks so much, David. And we're nearing the end of our show. Have a lovely night.
Thanks very much for having me, Marissa. And I hope your voice gets back to normal very soon.
Oh, it will. Don't worry. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
3CR is one of a kind. We have 400 volunteers and cover an incredible array of programming content.
From special broadcast events on Invasion Day or Trans Day of Visibility to any of our 120 weekly shows, 3CR has got your radical radio listening covered.
Subscribe to 3CR at 3cr.org.au and support independent, community-owned media, free of commercial influence and government bias.
Help to keep 3CR unique by becoming a subscriber today.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.
And this is the Doin' Time Show, 3CR, and it's approximately 4:54. And we're nearing the end of our show. Thank you to our guests that were interviewed today. And really wanted to thank Professor Dastari for coming on to talk about the new report in regards to a Human Rights Act. Do go onto the Human Rights Law Centre website and have a look at that. And also thank you to David and Ian for giving eyewitness accounts
at the March for Australia rallies. We do need to remain vigilant. It's very important that we all unite. The people united shall never be defeated. Just another reminder with the Human Rights Law Centre. The new report is called From the Whitlam Institute and Human Rights Law Centre. And do go onto the website to have a look. So it's goodbye from Marissa. And stay tuned every Monday for the Do and Time Show from 4 to 5 p.m. And we're going out now with our theme song, Black Fella, White Fella, by the Rumpy Band. Bye.
As long as you a true fella, as long as you a real fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter what your name is, we got to have lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout in? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan? Black fella, white fella, a yellow fella, any fella, it doesn't matter what you color, as long as you a true fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter which religions, it's all the same where the ship is sinking. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters, if we can save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it?
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.